Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 53, A Lion's Rest. I'm your host Fraser, delving once again into the rich tapestry of Scotland's past, where legends come to life and history shapes the nation we know today. In our previous journey together, we embarked on a grand adventure through the events of the Third Crusade. We uncovered the pivotal leaders, the fiercely contested battles, and the indomitable spirit of Richard I, whose valour in the Holy Land became the stuff of legend. We explored the intriguing role Scotland played in this monumental chapter of history, and pondered the profound impact the Crusade had on William I's reign, a reign characterised by resilience, strategic diplomacy, and an unwavering commitment to Scottish independence. Now, the episode was a thrilling ride through history, filled with tales of bravery, faith and intrigue, and as I mentioned, we might revisit the Crusades once more, coinciding with the Edward I's invasion of Scotland, but that's a story for another time, and probably the last time we'll touch upon the Crusades. Today, we pivot back to our political narrative, focusing on the twilight years of William I's reign. Known posthumously as William the Lion, his tenure on the Scottish throne was a rollercoaster of highs and lows. Yet through it all, his leadership ensured Scotland remained a sovereign and independent kingdom, a testament to his formidable prowess as a monarch. But, as with all tales, there comes a time to turn the page. Preparing to bid farewell to William is not something I do lightly. His impact on Scotland's history is profound, marking an era of significant development and enduring legacy. Yet, as the saying goes, history is a journey that marches ever onwards, and so must we. As we prepare to delve into the final chapter of William, starting from 1194, I invite you to settle in. Whether you're tuning in over a warm cup of tea, nestled comfortably with a radio, or plugged in through headphones, let's journey back together to a pivotal moment in Scotland's storied past. Today's tale will explore the nuanced political landscape of the time, William's relentless pursuit of Scottish independence, and the legacy he left behind. So, without further ado, let's step back into the annals of history to the reign of William, one last time, and witness the final act of a monarch whose name would forever echo in the halls of Scotland's history. Welcome once again to the History of Scotland. As we delve into the intricate web of medieval politics and territorial ambitions that defined the late 12th century, a significant switch up in England demands our attention. The year 1194 marks a pivotal moment, not just for England, but for Scotland and its monarch, William. Upon Richard I's return to England from his crusading ventures and subsequent captivity in the Holy Roman Empire, a momentous opportunity seemed to present itself to the Scottish king. William, sensing a chance to expand his realm and assert his claim, made a bold move to purchase Northumbria from Richard. Northumbria, with its rich history and strategic importance, was a jewel William had long set his eyes on, as we know. His claim to the region was strong, grounded in his historical rights of his grandfather and ambitions to bolster Scotland's position against its southern neighbour. William's offer was substantial. 15,000 marks, a staggering sum for the time, equivalent to approximately £10,000. However, this ambitious proposal hit an insurmountable obstacle. William wasn't just interested in the land, he wanted the castles within Northumbria, the symbols of power and the means to enforce his rule. Richard, understanding the strategic implications of surrendering such fortifications, flatly rejected the offer. The refusal underscored the complexity of medieval politics between Richard and William. But Richard I, known as a Lionheart for his military prowess and leadership during the Crusades, met an untimely end in France. His death in 1199 AD marked the closure of a chapter in England's history and heralded a period of uncertainty and transition. Richard's demise would have had significant repercussions for Scotland, as it brought to the English throne a new monarch, whose approach to rule and relations with Scotland contrasted sharply with that of his predecessor. In this tangled skein of ambition, rejection, and the quest for power, we see the contours of a relationship between Scotland and England that was defined as much by the aspirations of its rulers as by the lands they sought to control. Following Richard's death in 1199, his brother, John, ascended to the English throne, marking a significant shift in the leadership style and policies of England. John, unlike his brother Richard, who was celebrated for his military prowess and leadership during the Third Crusade, had a reputation that was, well, in many respects, the polar opposite of his predecessors. John, often referred to as John Lackland, for he had been expected to inherit little to no land as a younger son of Henry, was a ruler whose reign was made in controversy, conflict, and criticism. His approach to governance, diplomacy, and military strategy starkly contrasted with Richard's. Where Richard had been absent from England for much of his reign, focusing on crusades and continental politics, John's rule was predominantly England-centric. However, it was characterised by a series of failures and missteps that significantly impacted the kingdom's stability and John's reputation among his contemporaries and historians alike. John's reign saw the loss of vast territories in France to the French King Philip II, a result of military defeats and strategic failures. This not only diminished England's continental power, but also contributed to escalating tensions with the English nobility, eventually leading to the sealing of the famous Magna Carta in 1215. The document, a cornerstone of English constitutional history, was a direct response to John's heavy taxation and arbitrary rule, highlighting the stark difference in governance and relationship between the nobility compared to Richard's reign. Moreover, in our view of the world, John's dealings with Scotland, and William I in particular, was marked by opportunism and a fluctuating diplomacy. His interactions were often governed by the intermediate political or financial advantages that could bring to England, and they were obviously contrastingly different to Richard's dealership, let's say, with Scotland. This difference in approach had significant implications for the Anglo-Scottish relations, affecting all the treaties, marriages, and territorial negotiations throughout John's reign. In the year 1200 AD, a significant event unfolded that further illustrated the complex dynamics of Anglo-Scottish relations during this period. William, in a move that was both strategic and somewhat ceremonial, did homage for Northumbria to Richard's successor, John. This act was not for the Kingdom of Scotland itself, a crucial distinction that underscored William's commitment to maintaining Scotland's sovereignty, while navigating the intricate web of medieval feudal obligations and politics. This homage was in part an effort to save face following the unsuccessful bid to purchase Northumbria in 1194. By paying homage for these lands, William sought to preserve his dignity and assert his rights without directly challenging John's authority or escalating tensions between the two kingdoms. The homage to John over Northumbria was emblematic of the broader struggles and negotiations that characterised the relationships between the monarchs of England and Scotland. It was a gesture that on the surface acknowledged John's overlordship in this specific matter, yet it also allowed William to reaffirm his independence and the distinct identity of Scotland under his rule. This act of homage was a mere nuanced strategy, demonstrating William's changing acumen in managing his kingdom's relationship with a powerful and often unpredictable southern neighbour. Sadly though, things would show John to not be a true or gentle king. William heard that John was marching for war with Scotland. Despite Scotland regaining its independence, the fabric of Anglo-Scottish relations was stretched further during the early 13th century. Tensions bristled beneath a veneer of diplomatic engagements between the two kingdoms. In August 1209 AD, King John of England led a formidable military force to Northam, near the border town of Berwick. This show of strength was not merely a flexing of English military muscles, but a calculated move to exploit the perceived vulnerabilities within the Scottish leadership, held by the ageing William I. The ageing William perhaps recognising the precarious position in which he found himself, was compelled to make significant concessions to avoid open conflict. Among these was a substantial monetary promise to John, a move indicative of the diplomatic balancing acts that William had to perform. However, the concessions went beyond gold and silver. They extended into the very heart of William's family. To secure peace and perhaps to weave a tighter web of dynastic ties between the two kingdoms, William agreed to the marriages of his elder daughters to English nobles. A decision that underscored the intertwined destinies of Scottish and Anglo aristocracy. We've already gone over these daughters, but a quick recap. We had Margaret of Scotland, who was the Countess of Kent. She was married to Hubert de Burgh, the first Earl of Kent. We had Isabella of Scotland, the Countess of Norfolk, found a match in Roger Bigod, the fourth Earl of Norfolk. And then there was Marjorie of Scotland, who was married to Gilbert Marshall, the fourth Earl of Pembroke. These marriages were strategic, destined not only to ensure peace, but also to secure alliances and strengthen William's position both domestically and in relation to England. However, the diplomatic manoeuvres did not end with William's daughters. In 1212 AD, when the treaty was renewed, another significant agreement was reached. William's only surviving legitimate son and heir, Alexander, soon to be known as Alexander II, was betrothed to John's eldest daughter, Joan. This arrangement, perhaps the most poignant of all, was emblematic of William's efforts to safeguard Scotland's future through the web of European royal connections. William I's decision, let's say, to marry his daughter to English nobles and engage in diplomatic concessions rather than stand his ground against King John, displays a military might was rooted in complex interplay of power dynamics. It shows that William has changed from his early years of invading England. He's been a lot more smarter with Scotland's independence, making sure to preserve the peace and independence. Because this was at the foremost consideration for William when he was making this decision. It was to preserve Scottish independence. By marrying his daughters to English nobles, William sought to secure an uneasy peace that would prevent warfare, protect his people, and maintain Scotland's sovereignty. A sovereignty he fought long hard for. The marriages served as a diplomatic strategy as well to foster stronger ties between the Scottish and English courts. By intertwining the Scottish royal family with influential English nobles, William aimed to create a network of alliances that could offer Scotland political and military support, or at least deter English aggression through shared familial bonds. William's reign witnessed fluctuations in fortune and power, as we know. Marrying his daughters into the English nobility not only secured their personal positions, but also enhanced the prestige of the Scottish crown. These alliances could bolster Scotland's standing among European monarchies, projecting an image of strength and influence that transcended the kingdom's borders. These marriages were not merely passive concessions, but also strategic moves that could provide William with leverage in his negotiations with England in the future. Faced with the potential devastation of another open conflict, William opted for the path of lesser harm. The decision to marry his daughters to the English nobles, though difficult, was a calculated move to avoid the far more destructive outcomes of war. It was a pragmatic choice, emblematic of the real political considerations that often underpinned medieval diplomacy. With an aging monarch and the memory of the past conflicts had brought Scotland to the brink, securing a peaceful and stable environment for his successor was paramount. These alliances through marriage were part of William's broader effort to ensure that his heir, Alexander, soon to be known as Alexander II as I said, would inherit a kingdom that was stable, independent and strategically aligned with powerful allies. In the twilight years of his reign, William of Scotland, William I, focused on consolidating his legacy and reinforcing the spiritual and administrative foundations of his kingdom. Despite the challenges and tumults of his earlier reign, these final years were marked by significant contributions to Scotland's ecclesiastical and cultural heritage, reflecting a king who was as devoted to the spiritual welfare of his realm as he was to the political and territorial integrity. One of William's most enduring legacies is the founding of Arbroath Abbey in 1178. This establishment not only served as a religious centre, but also became a symbol of Scottish independence, especially with the latter drafting of the Declaration of Arbroath in 1320 AD. The abbey was proof of William's piety and his desire to promote religious and cultural flourishing within Scotland. Its foundation was also likely intended to curry favour with the heavens, an act of devotion from a monarch whose reign had weathered both excommunication and interdict in its early years. Furthermore, William's attention to the ecclesiastical structure of Scotland was evidenced by the establishment of the Bishopric of Argyll around 1192, a move that coincided with the papal confirmation of the Scottish Church by Pope Clestine III. This recognition was a significant achievement, as it underscored the autonomy of the Scottish Church, diminishing ecclesiastical influence and reaffirming the spiritual sovereignty that mirrored Scotland's political independence. The establishment of this bishopric was strategic, but also enabled to extend the ecclesiastical organisation and support the western parts of his kingdoms, areas that were crucial for consolidating his rule and integrating the diverse regions of Scotland under a unified church authority. These actions in his final years were reflective of a king having secured his realm against external threats and internal discord, sought to leave behind a legacy that transcended mere territorial conquests or political victories. By investing in the spiritual and cultural infrastructure of Scotland, William aimed to strengthen the bonds that unified his kingdom and to foster a sense of shared identity and purpose among his subjects. William's efforts to promote the church's role in Scotland were not merely acts of piety, but also strategic moves that intertwined the spiritual well-being of his realm with his political stability and independence. Through foundations like Arbroath Abbey and the establishment of the new bishoprics, William sought to ensure that his legacy would resonate not only through the annals of Scottish history, but also within the soul of Scotland itself. In 1214 AD, William I's remarkable reign came to a sincere close in Stirling, a site of significant historical and strategic importance in Scotland. His passing marked the end of an era that had seen Scotland navigate through periods of conflict, diplomatic challenges, and the significant internal development. Dying of natural causes, William left the throne to his only surviving son, Alexander, who would now be known as Alexander II, ensuring the continuity of his lineage and the Scottish monarchy. At his bedside, it's plausible to imagine a gathering of close family members, esteemed members of the clergy, and loyal nobles and courtiers who had served William throughout his reign. Such figures would have provided comfort and counsel in the final moments, and their presence would symbolise the unity and strength of the Scottish kingdom at a pivotal moment of transition. The transition of power from William to Alexander would have been governed by establishing rites and procedures designed to ensure a smooth succession. Key among these would have been the proclamation of the new king, homage and fealty, the coronation ceremony, which we've gone through at the start of William's reign, the continuity of the royal administration, the securing of alliances, the securing of religious endorsements. Thanks to William's efforts in governing and how his council of nobles secured the realm whilst William was away on his many different diplomatic ventures, Alexander's transition was a lot more peaceful than it was tumultuous. William's burial would have been another critical aspect of this transition, reflecting both his status as a monarch and his personal contributions to Scotland's religious life. Arbroath Abbey, founded by William, as we said, holds a place of great historical and cultural significance in Scotland, not least for being the final resting place for William himself. Over the centuries, the abbey has weathered the passage of time, enduring various states of preservation and ruin. Today it stands as a poignant monument to Scotland's medieval past, including its pivotal role in the history of Scottish independence, most famously at the site where the Declaration of Arbroath was drafted in 1320. Regarding the specific question of visiting William I's grave, it's important to note that while the Abbey is open to the public and managed by Historic Environment Scotland, direct access to William's grave as a distinct site might be a bit more complex. Over the years, many historical burial sites within the ancient ruins have become less distinguishable, and specific markers or tombs may have been eroded or lost. The exact location of William's grave within the Abbey might not be clearly marked or preserved in the way more modern graves are. Visitors to the Abbey can immerse themselves in the rich history of the site, and by extension pay their respects to William, by visiting the place of his burial. The Abbey itself offers a window into Scotland of William's time, its architecture and remnants telling the story of a period marked both by conflict and cultural flourishing. While you may not be able to stand directly at William's gravesite, walking the grounds of Arbroath Abbey connects you to the legacy of a king whose reign was instrumental in shaping the Scotland we know today. Now, if we look to Alexander's transition to the throne in 1214 at the death of his father, it was relatively smooth and unchallenged, a testament to the stability and legacy established by his father William. The seamless succession was significantly aided by William's effort to secure Scotland's independence and maintain a cohesive and loyal nobility. William's diplomatic endeavours, particularly his marriage alliances with English nobility and his foundational work in strengthening the Scottish Church, played a critical role in ensuring a stable environment for Alexander's ascension. William's reign, marked by the resilience in the face of external threats and internal disputes, laid a robust foundation for his son. Now, we aren't sure on the specific historical records detailing Alexander II's personal views of his father. It's reasonable to infer from the continuity of policies and furtherance of his father's ambitions that Alexander held William in high regard. Alexander continued to strengthen the position of Scotland within the British Isles and pursued policies that suggest he favoured his father's legacy of independence and resilience. His efforts to consolidate royal authority and extend Scottish influence further into the Isles and the borders hint at respect for his father's achievements and his desire to build upon them. Now, what of Ermengarde de Beaumont, the wife of William? Well, she played a significant role in the Scottish royal family, not just as queen consort, but through her influence in the political and cultural spheres. Born into the French nobility, her marriage to William in 1186, as we know, was part of the broader pattern of dynastic alliances that characterised the medieval period. But after William's death in 1214, Ermengarde continued to play a notable figure in Scotland. She survived her husband by several years, living until 1234 AD. During her widowhood, Ermengarde took on the role of a matriarch and was actively involved in the affairs of the kingdom, particularly in the upbringing and guidance of her grandchildren. Her role during this period was crucial in ensuring the stability of the succession and maintaining the continuity of William's legacy through his descendants. Ermengarde's contributions went beyond political. She's remembered for her patronage of religious institutions and her involvement in the establishment of the Abbey of Balmerino in Fife in 1229 AD. The Abbey was founded as a Sistine monastery, and Ermengarde's support for it reflect the broader trend of monastic patronage by the Scottish royalty and nobility, which played a significant role in the cultural and spiritual life of medieval Scotland. Ermengarde de Beaumont was buried in this abbey, a testament to her piety and her contributions to the church. Her legacy, like that of her husband, is intertwined with the religious and political history of Scotland, highlighting the influential roles played by both royal consorts in the governance and cultural development of their realms. William's reign during a pivotal period in Scottish history and his legacy has been interpreted variously by chroniclers and historians over the centuries. The views on his reign have evolved, reflecting the changing priorities and perspective of those writing the history. So if we go through some of those now, one of the primary chroniclers of William's time was Roger de Hoveden. An English chronicler, he provided a detailed account of the late 12th century and early 13th century. While Hoveden's accounts are more focused on English affairs, his references to William I often portrayed the Scottish king within the broader context of Anglo-Scottish relations. For instance, Hoveden recounts the events surrounding the Treaty of Alluce, where William I was captured by the English, noting, "King William of Scotland was led to the King of England and swore fealty to him with his hands between the king's hands as the liegeman against all men." This captured the moment of William's greatest political vulnerability, but also sets the stage for his later efforts to regain Scottish independence. In the centuries following William's reign, historical interpretations have shifted. By the late 18th and early 19th century and afterward, historians began to assess William's legacy in the context of Scotland's national identity and its struggle for independence. One notable figure in this re-evaluation was the 19th century historian William Forbes, who in his work Celtic Scotland provides a more nuanced view of William's reign, emphasising his efforts to consolidate Scottish independence and authority. William Forbes describes William's reign as one marked by significant challenges, but also by resilience and strategic acumen in dealing with both internal and external threats. In the 20th century, the historian Geoffrey Barrow offered a detailed reassessment of William's reign in his seminal work Kingship and Unity, Scotland, 1000 to 1306. Barrow portrays William as a ruler who, despite his early setbacks, showed considerable skill in governance and diplomacy, notably in his efforts to restore and maintain Scotland's independence from English overlordship. Barrow suggests that William's legacy is complex, marked by both the challenges he faced and the resilience he demonstrated in overcoming them. In contemporary scholarship, historians continue to explore the intricacies of William's reign, often focusing on his contributions to the development of the Scottish state and the legal system. For instance, modern historians highlight William's role in promoting the use of the written charters and developing the administrative structures of the Scottish kingdoms. His legacy, once overshadowed by the circumstances of his capture and submission to Henry II of England, have been, well, re-evaluated, let's say, to highlight his resilience in his role of fostering Scottish independence and his contributions to the governance of the kingdom. But what about the moniker William the Lion? Well, it wasn't used during his lifetime, but in the centuries following his reign. This epithet is to derive from the adoption of the lion rampart as part of his royal standard. A golden lion rampart within a double treasure flow counterflurry on the red field, which became a potent symbol of Scottish sovereignty and a key element of Scotland's heraldic identity. The lion emblem, which William is credited with introducing to Scotland's royal coat of arms, came to symbolise courage, strength and nobility, qualities that were associated with William's kingship, despite the challenges he faced during his reign. The appellation, the lion, thus reflects not only William's personal qualities as a leader, but also his strategic use of symbols to assert and reinforce Scotland's national identity. Over time, this association between William and the lion emblem has solidified his legacy as a monarch who, despite his, well, capture, embodied the resilience and dignity of the Scottish kingdom. Now, William I's reign spanned nearly 50 years, from 1165 to 1214, and it was one of the longest in Scottish history, and by many measures, one of its most formative. Assessing his reign relative to other Scottish rulers involves considering the challenges he faced, his responses to these challenges, and the lasting impacts of his policies and actions on the Kingdom of Scotland. William's reign was marked by significant highs and lows, as we know. He inherited a kingdom at the time when the concept of nationhood was still evolving, and his efforts to maintain and expand Scottish independence were pivotal. His predecessors, such as David I, had laid the groundwork for a more centralised and European-influenced Scotland through the introduction of feudalism and the expansion of trade. William built upon these foundations, but faced greater external challenges, notably from England. William undoubtedly was a strong leader, who determined to secure Scotland's independence from English overlordship. His efforts to regain control of Northumbria territories through untimely unsuccessful demonstrated his commitment to this cause. the diplomatic marriages and alliances strengthened Scotland's legal and administrative systems were significant achievements that contributed to the kingdom's stability and growth. William's establishment of royal boroughs also boosted the economy, encouraging trade and crafts and carrying on David I's legacy. Some aspects of William's reign, though, could be viewed less favourably. As we know, at the capture of the Battle of Alnwick in 1174, it led to the Treaty of Alluce, where William was forced to swear fealty to Henry II, a humiliating concession that compromised Scotland's independence. Although this submission was later rescinded, it represented a significant low point in his reign, and demonstrated the perils of military overreach, and especially the charging by himself against a ton of English knights when he was outnumbered. William's reign was pivotal in integrating Scotland more fully into the European mainstream. Through his marriage to Irmgard de Beaumont, a member of the Anglo-Norman aristocracy, and his interactions with the papacy, William strengthened Scotland's ties to continental Europe. These connections were not just political, but also cultural and economic, facilitating the flow of ideas, goods, and people that enriched the Scottish society. Furthermore, William's efforts to centralise royal authority, improve legal systems, and patronise religious institutions helped align Scotland more closely with the feudal and chivalric norms of medieval Europe. The founding of Arbroath Abbey and the establishment of the Bishopric of Argyll proof of this European orientation, reflecting a broader pattern of ecclesiastical reform and monastic patronage that connected Scotland with major religious movements across the continent. Overall, William's reign was a period of significant development for Scotland, laying the groundwork for future expansion and consolidation under his successors. His leadership, characterised by a mix of military ambition, diplomatic manoeuvring, and administrative innovation, faced both triumphs and setbacks. Yet it was his ability to navigate the complex political landscape of the time that ultimately defined his legacy. While not without its controversies, William's reign significantly contributed to the shaping of a distinct Scottish identity and laid the foundation for Scotland's emergence as a more coherent and unified kingdom on the European stage. Well, that wraps up our exploration of William, a figure whose reign was as complex as it was transformative for Scotland. I truly hope you've enjoyed going on this journey through his life and legacy, as fascinating as I have. It's a fun fact to note that William, again, was one of Scotland's longest reigning monarchs, a distinction that not even the renowned David I could have claimed to. His ability to navigate the turbulent waters of medieval politics, while not without its ebbs and flows, remain a significant part of Scotland's storied past. Looking ahead, we're set to delve into the life of his son and heir, Alexander II of Scotland. Coming episodes will pose intriguing questions. Will Alexander's reign echo the combativeness that characterised his father's rule, or will it steer a course towards a more peaceful horizon like Malcolm IV? How will he measure up to the legacy left by William? These are just a few of the threads we'll unravel as we continue our journey through the annals of Scottish history, so be sure to stay tuned for the next 3-4 episodes covering his reign. But anyway, as always, remember our podcasts are released weekly, with the next episode dropping next week, keeping to our schedule of 3 episodes a month. If you're enjoying the journey as much as I am, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at the History of SE1. That is at the History of SE1, or check out our Facebook page at the History of Scotland podcast. Your engagement and feedback help us grow and refine our content, so we would love to hear your thoughts. For those eager to never miss an episode, you can find us on a variety of platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and many other fantastic podcasting sites. Whether you're on a long commute, taking a brisk walk, or simply enjoying a moment of leisure, our episodes are designed to immerse you in the rich tapestry of Scotland's past. As we draw the episode to a close, I want to thank you all for joining me on this historical journey again. Your curiosity and enthusiasm make all the difference. So, until the next time, guys, have a great week ahead, and here's to uncovering more fascinating stories from Scotland's history together. Until next week, stay safe, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace.